Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host Jennifer Han and we are joined today by a bit of a different guest. Simon Horton began his career as a management consultant but decided to change lanes and has now been teaching negotiation tactics for nearly 15 years to everyone from law firms and banks to government departments and hostage negotiators. We've brought him on today to talk about the Brexit negotiations, but first, Simon, I'm curious how you go from being a management consultant to teaching negotiation tactics.
Yes, very good question. I went a roundabout way. It wasn't something that was planned at all. I actually got into NLP. NLP is neuro-linguistic programming.
Okay.
And it's kind of applied psychology. It's kind of, what does current neuroscience say about the brain, how the brain actually works? And then if the brain does work that way, how do we use that knowledge to achieve our goals better? Either to be happier or more confident, or to communicate better, to influence people better, to negotiate with other people better.
Okay, so how would you say that generally applies within political negotiations? Or first of all, maybe negotiations in general?
So negotiations is very psychological. 9 times out of 10, you're negotiating with somebody else, and if you want to get your message across, you need to understand their perspective on that situation. You need to understand their drivers. You need to understand their values. You need to understand the best way of putting your message across that's going to work with that individual. You might have the same message, two people. You'll say it one way for one person and another way for another person. To know the way that's going to work most successfully, you need to understand the other person. So it's all about psychology.
Okay. So do you think politicians, I'm assuming they're not trained in this generally?
No, I don't think they are. I think politicians actually aren't trained in negotiation either.
Mm.
And I think politicians typically aren't the best negotiators. They typically follow the old school approach to negotiation, which is ego-based. It's power-based. There's cloak and dagger. There's an element of deceit, this kind of stuff.
Okay, so if you could give me a bit more of a detailed rundown of sort of what the strategies would normally be that you would use to convince someone else of your opinion and where maybe our politicians might be falling short in that regard.
Yes, okay. So in terms of convincing people, the most common strategy is to say your message, repeat it again, and repeat it louder. And generally, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Typically, people aren't very good at persuading other people. And take Brexit as an example. How many people do you know have changed their minds about Brexit since the referendum? Very, very few. So persuading people actually is a difficult thing. Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, he said, if you want to persuade somebody, you need to play back their message to them better than they could have done it themselves.
Mm.
And then and only then say your message. So play back their message better than they could have said it themselves to show you've really got, that you've really listened and you've really got their point.
Mm.
And then and only then put your message across. Now, I think there's more to it than that because Daniel Dennett works obviously in a very logical, as a philosopher, he's very logical academic context. Things like Brexit are much more complicated. There's a lot of emotion involved. So you've got to not just understand and show you understand the other person's argument. You've got to show that you get the emotion as well. The most successful model framework that I know of is what hostage negotiators use. Hostage negotiators obviously work in quite extreme circumstances. And they all follow the same, or certainly in the UK and in the US, they all follow the same framework, which is a 5-step process. It's very straightforward. Firstly, listen. Secondly, show empathy. Thirdly, build rapport. Fourthly, influence, get your message across. And then fifthly, you get the behavioural change. So really, right. the behavioural change is for them to change their mind. Really, it's only 4 things you've got to do. But what we normally do, Chris Voss, who's the FBI head of international negotiations team, he says the most common mistake what we do is we go straight to step 4. Straight to try to influence, try to persuade, put our message across. And we miss out steps 1 to 3. And it just doesn't work. We have to listen. We have to build show empathy, and we have to build rapport first.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that doesn't sound like the qualities of a politician, especially right now in this current political climate. Can you give me your take on it a bit? What do you think about negotiations, how they've been going this far?
Yes, it's interesting. I've been hoping for best practice. I haven't seen a lot of it. It's been a bit of a mixed bag. I think we have to make a distinction between that there are different layers of negotiations going on and different layers of negotiators. You've got the trade negotiators, the professional trade negotiators on both sides. And I think they're probably doing a great job. And they're probably following best practice. They're probably highly experienced, highly skilled. And if you leave them to it, they will go out and get a great outcome.
Just to clarify, best practice meaning those five steps?
Those five steps, looking at it from a different perspective, we might say looking for a collaborative win-win outcome.
Okay.
Rather than a power battle, looking for a solution that both parties go away happy with the outcome.
Okay.
So if we left it to the professionals, who are meeting on a regular basis, I'm sure they'd come up with a great outcome. But then we have the politicians on top. And if we look at the difference, published positions of the two sides, of the British government and of the EU, if you look at those side by side, there are solutions to be had reasonably straightforwardly. If it goes wrong, if we don't get the outcome that everybody's happy with, it's probably because of the politicians.
Yeah,
so if you,
as always.
So you kind of asked me, how has it been going to date? Well, let's say rule one of negotiation is know what you want to achieve. And we are 15 months post-referendum, and we've still got very little idea of what we want to achieve. We're already kind of 5 months into the negotiation, and Article 50 really only allows 18 months of negotiation. And we're at 5 months in, and we still aren't clear. The government still haven't released their positions on most of the major situations.
Yeah, I was just about to say, a senior British diplomat called Sir Simon Fraser,
yes.
My apologies,
yes.
Who was a chief Mandarin at the Foreign Office until 2015, said that negotiations did not begin well because the UK side does not seem united and does not have a clear position. How do negotiations usually unfold when someone doesn't have a clear thing that they're striving for?
It's going to be really difficult, because how can you achieve a good outcome if you don't know what that outcome looks like? Now, I think in this instance, to be fair to the British politicians in this context, they have got a difficult circle to square, if you like. That if the output of the referendum was a majority for leaving, but with no clear idea of what leaving actually meant.
Mm.
And so I don't think there's a single defined outcome or version of what leaving means where there's a majority. So any version that we go for, whether it's hard Brexit, soft Brexit, or any variation in between, it's going to upset some people. And that's the problem that we've got at the moment. And I think it is going to be interesting, whatever they negotiate, then they're going to put it back to the Parliament to vote on.
Mm.
And there's going to be, I think, whatever outcome they come up with, there's likely to be significant pushback against that.
So do you know about anything about who's negotiating on either side and what the sort of process is going to be about with negotiations?
So the process is that we triggered Article 50 in March 2017. We've got 2 years to reach an agreement. So that's March 2019. It will require 6 months to ratify. So that really means October 2018. To start off with, we're talking about the divorce separation element, the divorce settlement element, if you like. And by October, Michel Barnier is going to report back to the EU whether he thinks we've made sufficient progress on that.
Yeah. And that's the chief negotiator for
the
EU.
He's the chief
right?
negotiator
yeah.
of the EU, exactly. He's David Davis's counterpart. Mm. He's going to report back whether he thinks they've made sufficient progress. If he thinks they have, we can then start talking about the future relationship, and we'll have a year, if you like, to talk about that. I expected further progress than we've had so far. It's exceedingly unpredictable, and it changes on a daily basis. if we go back to if we go back to the initial referendum, and it was everybody we voted for Brexit for leaving, and I thought about it, and I thought, well, okay, we'll probably negotiate something quite similar to where we are now. Then, as things unfolded, and the EU started talking about punishment, and David Davis responded with, "No deal is better than a bad deal." Earlier on this year, it was looking like a hard Brexit and quite an acrimonious hard Brexit. But then just before Article 50 was triggered, the two sides published their positions, their official positions. And if you put those side by side, actually, there's a lot of possibility for agreement and of quite rapid agreement. And I was, they meet once a month. And they have a week where they meet formally face to face in that month. We've had two so far because the election wasted 3 months straight away.
Yeah.
We've had two of those meetings so far. I was hoping for very quick announcements on agreements, for example, on residence rights, where, to be honest, both sides are very close to each other on residence rights. So I thought a quick announcement on agreement there, quick an announcement on the idea of a transition period, quick announcement of progress, not final details, but progress on the divorce bill, what that bill is likely to be, how they're going to calculate it, if nothing else. And all of that would build positive momentum, and it would be very good diplomatically. But we're 5 months in and we've made virtually no progress. We're a month and a half away from October, where Michel Barnier is going to make his decision. I think that's going to be an interesting point. We're going to get a good indication of likely success then. Because if he says in his report back to the EU, yeah, we've made great progress, good, good, then I think we'll probably get a good deal at the end of the 2 years. If he says, look, we haven't made sufficient progress yet, but I think by next month, November, yes, we probably will, then fine. We'll be cutting it fine, but we'll probably get a good deal. But if he says, no, we really haven't made sufficient progress, and you, UK, you're going to have to make a lot more movement before we start going anywhere near talking about the future relationship. If that's his angle, then I think we're in for a tough time, and I'd be surprised if we got a good mutual agreement at the end of the 2 years.
So you think the result of that would be, of that worst case scenario, that we basically just don't get anything that we originally were negotiating for?
It's quite possible. I think the no deal, the cliff edge thing, is quite possible. I think that's a very, very real possibility. Interestingly, going back to negotiation best practice, when David Davis said no deal is better than a bad deal, actually, that was good practice from a negotiation perspective. He was right to say that. Because the EU were talking about power. They were talking about punishing Britain. And he instantly removed that and said, well, if you don't give us what we want, we're fine. We're going to go off. We're very happy with the alternative. We're going to become a tax haven, and we're very happy with it. From a negotiation perspective, that was the right thing to do. From a political perspective, though, I think that was where the difficulty was. Suddenly, the majority of Britain turned around and said, well, hold on, no, we're not happy with that. Yeah. You might be happy with it, Bill Cash might be happy with it, but we are not, kind of thing. So I think, given how comfortable David Davis is with that as an option, I think there's a real chance that egos, offended feelings and these kinds of things might just take it down that route.
Who do you think has the stronger hand overall then? Because as you just mentioned, there's no one opinion within the UK, but then presumably, considering how many member states there are, there isn't in the EU as well, maybe a bit more united than the UK, but still differing levels of how much the UK should be punished, quote unquote.
Yes, yes.
So who do you think has the upper hand, really?
Well, I would say the EU has got the strongest position. But going back to best practice negotiation, you shouldn't really be talking about power. If you force something through because you can, because you've got the power, you'll probably find that the other party will agree because they've got to, but they'll find a way of sabotaging it, find a way of evening things up. There's a great example of that in recent years with the horse meat scandal. So there you had the supermarkets absolutely put pressure on the suppliers and just really squeeze them down because they could. And the supplier said, okay, well, whatever, we'll sign. And what they did is that they just put horse meat in the burger instead of beef.
Mm.
So the win-lose power-based approach typically becomes lose-lose. So you want to remove power from the equation.
Funnily enough, there's been some anecdotal evidence that this hasn't really happened yet, as an anonymous civil servant revealed to the New Statesman that British negotiators were denied water during talks in Brussels, apparently to gain a competitive advantage. How much do you think there is to this? That is probably quite hard to judge, but is this a common tactic? Did you expect something like this to happen?
To be honest, I really hope not. I really hope it's not true.
Yeah.
It's kind of so bad, so beyond bad, that it's almost like a pantomime thing. Kind of, let's not give them water and let's put the light in their face and we'll put them on really small chairs.
Like a sort of spoof of what an investigation is, with a detective shining light.
Exactly.
Like, tell me everything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping it's not true.
Mm.
One of the things that we do have to bear in mind is that there's what's going on at the press in the media level, and then there's what's actually going on, and we do need to make that distinction. Do I think it's true? I really hope not. It doesn't work, in fact. It will become counterproductive. There are lots of contextual things you can do to get a good result. And in the kind of science of negotiation, there's lots of things that you can do just in the room to get a good result. But not giving them water isn't one of them. That would be counterproductive. Funny enough, the opposite, give them food, and give them good food means they're going to be much more collaborative and much more going to give you what you want than the opposite. There's a good story of that. A couple of years ago, Glencore and Xstrata, two of the largest mining companies in the world, were looking to merge. The negotiations were stalling because the major shareholders in Xstrata didn't like the terms as they stood. So it turned out that these shareholders in Xstrata, it was the Qatar royal family, they were best friends with Tony Blair. Tony Blair was also best friends with the chief exec of Glencore. So they all went for dinner at Claridge's, and over very good food and fine wine, they bashed it out. So it's quite the opposite. You know, bring food to the table, be friendly, be charming, these kinds of things. And then you're much more likely for them to get them to give you what you want.
Another thing that emerged about negotiations is that civil servants, English civil servants, had some fears that maybe their phones and smartwatches were being hacked, especially by the French. For some reason, it was especially the French that were being picked out for this. Do you think that's sort of that they've internalized this paranoia by themselves, or that this might actually be a strategy from the EU to try and sort of unsettle them a bit in negotiations?
It's interesting. Again, I don't really know. It may be more that actually they want to isolate their position from the press, again, rather than from the other side. Again, going back to best practice, interestingly, everybody thinks hold your cards close to your chest. Don't let the other side know what you're thinking. Everybody thinks that's good negotiation tactics. It turns out that it's not. In fact, the more open you are, the more collaborative you are, the more you put your cards on the table, the more likely you are to get the solution that you really want.
Yeah, that does sound like the reasonable option, really.
Yes.
But I suppose to a politician, the reasonable option is never sort of...
But you would hope our politicians, who are supposed to be representing us and who are supposed to be the best of the best, might be reasonable on occasions.
Yeah. So are you surprised that this kind of stuff has come out now, regardless of whether it's true or not? Did you expect it to get this sort of dirty really early on, or were you hoping for everyone to rise above it?
I was hoping people would rise above it. I think, interestingly, why is it like this? Why has it gone like this? Why did the EU... in very early days, start talking about punishment and penalties. I think one of the reasons is that when Theresa May was elected Prime Minister and she said, right, we are now going to negotiate the Brexit terms, the people she put in charge of those negotiations, David Davis, Liam Fox and Boris Johnson, They were the three main ministers closest to those negotiations. That, I think, was quite inflammatory. They were the people who the EU totally blamed for this problem. And she's now saying, right, you go and talk to these guys. Mm. So I think it was quite inflammatory. And so I think the EU quite understandably thought, well, we might like Britain and we might be able to trust Britain and negotiate successfully with Britain, but I'm not sure about these particular people.
Mm.
So I think there was an element of that that I'm not sure we can trust. Michel Barnier, if you look at a lot of his speeches and that, they're guarded. They're saying he wants to come to a good solution, but he's saying, but let's see. Let's see what Britain does. And I don't think he fully trusts kind of the internal politics within Britain.
Yeah. If this high level of tension then is what's standing in the way of finding a good agreement, what's the way to de-escalate? Is there a way to de-escalate this
yes.
situation a little to
yes.
get more productive?
Yes, absolutely. My recommendation to David Davis would be to do a charm offensive on Michel Barnier, on the European leaders, on the European people. Become friends with Michel Barnier. There's a story about Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan. First time they met, the meeting went disastrously. Two empires that were enemies, the meeting went disastrously. Ronald Reagan recognized this halfway through and he paused and he said, this isn't going very well, is it? Should we start again? He said, hi, my name is Ron. Can I call you Mikhail? And he put his hand out to shake Gorbachev's hand. At that point, the Cold War ended. At that point, it stopped being enemy to enemy. It stopped being empire to empire, president to president. And it became human to human. It became friend to friend. They became friends. Their deputies, Shevardnadze and Schultz, became best of friends. They'd go on holiday with each other. They'd go sailing together. They would stay at each other's house. You know, they'd go nightclub. No, they wouldn't go nightclub. but they became best of friends. So if I think for David Davis to win around Michel Barnier, he's got to become friends. I think he should do a charm offensive of the European population, of the people. Because if there's politics involved, well, he's got to get the people on board as well. He should do a European tour. He should go on the chat shows or the TV programs across Europe, recognizing that there's a love-hate relationship, acknowledging all of the things that he knows the French, the German, the Spanish, the Italians don't like about us, the things that we've done wrong in the whole of this, the things that they just don't like about us. Then start, acknowledge all of that, then start talking about, yeah, but the things that they love about us to remind them of all of those, and then start talking about the benefits of negotiating a new collaborative outcome together. And if he were to do that, he would be able to get people on board.
Arguably, though, it's probably not in the EU's interest to make this a nice process and to sort of build that friendship with the UK still, because then it would sort of be not necessarily encouraging, but sort of making it seem a lot easier for other countries to leave as well, which obviously they want to discourage.
Yes, that you're right. That's a factor. As part of the politics, that is a factor. In a way, I think if the EU is taking that stance, it's showing a weakness in their own position. The EU should be strong enough in their own position that other people aren't going to want to leave. The UK are an exception. There is the specific reasons why we want to leave. They don't want to punish Britain, because if it is a punishment situation, it will become lose-lose. Britain will become a tax haven, and we will just undercut on their doorstep. We will undercut them repeatedly, and we will become the Panama kind of offshore, and it won't be good for Europe. We're not going to move away. We're always going to be here. So we want to be able to work together moving forward.
Yeah. So lastly, do you then have any negotiation tips for Michel Barnier?
I would say to do the same as I said to David Davis, try
okay.
and become friends. I think he should... See, but one thing that both sides did well is they listened to their own people. Michel Barnier did a tour of Europe, an extensive tour of Europe, but he didn't come over here. He didn't speak to anybody over here. Same with David Davis. He didn't go over to Europe to talk to anybody, find out their positions. So I think Michel Barnier should come over here to talk to us and try and get us on side. So it's not enemy to enemy, it's friend to friend, it's neighbour to neighbour.
That is definitely the utopian solution. How do you see the chances of that actually happening?
I really don't know. Every day I think it's going to go one way, there'll be something in the news that says it's going to go the other way. And then the next day there'll be something in the news that says it's going to go the other way again. So I've thrown my crystal ball away.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's about a summary of the entire Brexit process as far, isn't it?
Exactly.
On that note, Simon, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's been really informative.
Thank you very much.
As always, thanks for listening. And if you enjoy the show, please feel free to subscribe to us and follow us on the usual social networks at Brexit Podcast and at brexitpodcast.com to stay up to date on all the best Brexit news and opinions. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming and Warren Paul, and our theme song is courtesy of Kevin MacLeod.